This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available, the show, on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Mary Jo McConaughey, a longtime Latin American reporter and someone who's written a fascinating book we're going to get our arms around and figure out, called The Tango Wars: The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. Welcome to Wade's World, Mary Jo.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Now, World War II is not a normal topic for us, but our interest in Latin America made this book something we wanted to take a look at, and this is a fascinating way you've approached this subject. Why don't you give people a sense of how you came to this, though, which is sort of an interesting backstory as well.
Well, I had reported on Latin America for 30 years and had already written a couple of memoirs and wanted to write another book, but not about me. And I remembered stories that my father, who was a U.S. Navy officer during the Second World War, had told me about many places in the world, but also about Latin America. And yet I could not find a book that it would be in English, of course, and that would give me the whole arc of what had happened in Latin America during the Second World War. Even though I'd heard bits and pieces over the years in Latin America, but, you know, when you're reporting, you can never follow up these intriguing...
Yeah, I imagine. You're hearing tangents here and there.
Right, exactly. So I finally just decided I want to write the book that I wanted to read.
Well, and one of the interesting things I saw in your book is I don't remember how you got this information, but I think people would be surprised that Latin America was on the top of the list so often in strategic thinking about World War II.
Oh, absolutely. President Roosevelt was extremely concerned about Latin America, both because of its geography right next to the United States and only 1,800 miles from the hump of Brazil to the hump of Africa, which eventually, of course, was taken over by the Nazis, but also because of the huge amount of materials, oil, rubber, tungsten, manganese, that were needed for any war machine. And he was also concerned that these populations of ethnic Germans and ethnic Japanese could be a fifth column. In fact, of 100 meetings of the people who were planning for war, the Joint Planning Committee of the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, this is a thing I caught too, yeah.
And State and War Departments. Of 100 meetings that they had in 39 and 40, all but six had Latin America at the top of the agenda. We don't have an idea today of what went on at that time.
No, and it's such a different time. But this resource exploitation has always been a huge issue in Latin America, and I'm sure you stumbled onto this over your career reporting down there as well. But the resource contest was pretty aggressive.
Well, yes, oil and rubber were extremely fundamental. They were absolutely fundamental to waging of war. And oil, for instance, was in Mexico more than any other country. They had the greatest reserves. And yet, because the president of Mexico, who was a Democrat, unlike many Latin American leaders, he was not pro-fascist. But nevertheless, he had to nationalize the oil of Mexico in order to pay for a lot of the social programs that he had. He had his own kind of New Deal, like Roosevelt had. And the oil companies, big oil, would not agree with that and made a big embargo, global embargo, against Mexican oil, which ultimately forced the president of Mexico, Cárdenas, to sell to the people who were banging on his door, which was the Reich, Germany, and Italy.
And he eventually, I mean, this was quite a contest, but eventually he moved.
Sorry, I just lost you there. It was quite a contest?
It was quite a contest, but eventually I think the U.S. was able to get some access to Mexican oil.
Eventually, at first, because he couldn't sell it to the United States or to Britain or to Republican Spain, which he wanted to do, he sold it to a small oil dealer called William Davis. And William Davis went over to Germany, had a state-of-the-art refinery built by Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, Charles and David, about whom we read in the papers today.
And who made them rich.
them rich, that's for sure. Well, he had already built 12, Fred Koch had already built 12 refineries for Stalin, and he became rather disaffected with Stalin and was an admirer of Hitler's way of doing things in terms of the way he got industry going and the way he ran the country, and so was perfectly happy to build there for Hitler. So at any rate, that oil fueled the first victories of Hitler, the invasion of Poland and France. And it made it made certain people rich, but it also gave him a market. Eventually, Roosevelt convinced the companies that this was completely unpatriotic, but we started buying from Mexico. But by that time, a lot of damage had been done.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned, as we got into this question of resources, that there were extensive populations that people, I think, forget that there were significant German populations, for example, in Brazil.
Yes. In Brazil, the southern part, even if you go there today, you feel in some towns as if they were plucked right out of Bavaria or someplace in Germany. They're with the architecture and the look of the people. And there were 1 million ethnic Germans in southern Brazil at the beginning of the war. And this was of great concern to Roosevelt. There were Japanese growing cotton in Peru. The largest Japanese population outside of Japan was in Brazil.
And, of course, Fujimori, who ended up ruling Peru for quite a long time as a virtual dictator, was Japanese in origin. Didn't speak Japanese, I don't believe, but that's when you see the name Fujimori, you're sort of surprised that Peru? What's it? Is that in Peru? But this was not uncommon that many countries, obviously Argentina has a huge population that originally came from Italy, for example.
Sure.
So this must have been very scary to a number of the war planners.
Absolutely. They were concerned about a fifth column, and they were concerned about fascism getting a foothold in the Latin American countries. In fact, the countries had their own versions of fascism. They didn't have to be connected automatically to the Nazis in Berlin to have fascist groups, very militaristic in Mexico, for instance, in Brazil, and to have people who were on the side of the Reich. And on the other hand, many, many of the ethnic Germans and Japanese, and certainly the ethnic Italians, were considering themselves Mexican or Guatemalan or Brazilian first. So it's not at all the case that automatically they would be a fifth column. But that was the concern of Roosevelt. They pretty much, the American war planners, tarred everyone with the same brush with regard to people with backgrounds in the Axis countries, to the point that there was a secret kidnapping program in the State Department, which targeted ethnic Germans and Japanese and kidnapped more than 8,000 of them out of Latin America, many born there or certainly legal residents, and brought them to the United States, put them in concentration camps, especially in Texas for the families, and used them for trade bait to exchange for U.S. prisoners who were caught behind enemy lines, for civilians who were caught behind enemy lines.
And of course, we should be shocked, but in the U.S., we had a Japanese internment program. My last name is Rathke, which is a German name, and you know, I can remember my grandmother in Orange County, California, and my dad talking about it. She always spoke German in the house, but they stopped before World War II because they didn't want people to believe that they, you know, the same thing, that there was,
exactly,
you know, all this discussion about fifth columns among Germans and Japanese in the U.S. So I guess we shouldn't be shocked to find, but we're talking to Mary Jo Conahy, who's written a fascinating book that we're deep into now, The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. Didn't this also, this kidnapping is sort of shocking. I mean, where were you able to find that information?
You know, I had heard little bits and pieces of this, and it was hard for me to believe.
Yeah.
But then I did find a couple of books by scholars who spoke about aspects of this. And so you know, I'm a reporter. I'm not an historian.
Right.
So I go about things like a journalist, and I thought, well, maybe there are some people still with us who could speak to this as eyewitnesses. And I started looking around and getting on the phone and going through networks, and I was able to find people who were children at the time, but with very clear memories of what had happened to them, being kidnapped from Peru especially. In fact, this is difficult for people to believe, but when I got on the phone with one man, he said, well, where do you live? And I said, oh, no, I'll come to you. And it turned out that he lived one block from my house. And he and his three brothers had been taken from Peru and put in a camp in Texas where they grew up and even had to remain after the war. It told me that this kind of history is all around us if we just know where to look.
Wow. That's what a story that is. And now, did this, I mean, you get to this later in the book, but this these pre-existing populations also go some distance in explaining how after the war, we ended up with Nazi war criminals, so to speak, embedded in Paraguay, Argentina, I mean, various kinds of various countries where there were significant ethnic populations.
Yes, that's the case. Now, we have to remember that at the end of the war, the United States wanted certain Nazis. Russia wanted certain Nazis for the defense and aeronautics programs. And we took our pick, and many others went to Latin America by way of what are called the rat lines. And those were facilitated by certain bishops in the Catholic Church who were virulently anti-communist and felt that people who were Nazi needed to be saved for the coming war against communism. In fact, one of the bishops said, we have to maintain a moral reserve for the future. And for that reason, they helped these war criminals get to Latin America.
That sort of takes your breath away. I just had been in Brussels having a Skype meeting with somebody in Brazil who was a consultant for the Miserior Foundation, which is a German Catholic foundation, going around Latin America evaluating projects they now fund. So same bishops, hopefully a different program, but, when you just said that, I said, unfortunately, sometimes the apple doesn't go as far from the tree as it needs to go. You mentioned the Brucero program at different points. I mean, we're in a, just to bring all this up to today, I mean, over the last year or two, as certainly you know, and virtually everybody who listens to this show, we've been in a wars for years about immigration. And one of the things that was proposed as a substitute for real immigration reform was reviving the Brucero program. Did many people understand exactly how that program works and what impact it had both on the U.S. and in Latin America?
Well, the Brucero program was a very positive move that happened toward the last years of the war. Why was it positive? Because it was able to take people from Mexico who were underemployed and who were looking for work and bring them to the United States where they could work in replacement of men, almost all men, who were gone off to war. And the Braceros really fed the troops and fed a large number of the U.S. population. Now, the Bracero program was only meant to be, I think, 6 months, but in fact, it didn't end until 1964. And while there were positive things that came out of it, there were a lot of abuses, too. And very often, the workers didn't get the full legal backing that they ought to have received. And so there were repercussions, of the war 10 or 20 years after the war. And that's very much how many people are looking at this outflow of migrants from Central America now. That is, the wars that I covered, for instance, in the 1980s in El Salvador and Guatemala, and in Honduras, really, really tore up those countries and tore up all the social nets and tore up the communities. And in many ways, we're seeing the result of that now. You know, one of the things, Wade, that I hope that people get from reading this book is to see that once war is begun, It has no limits in time or in space.
That's a very important point. I think we could keep the list. Certainly, there's no moral ground. There's no seemingly ethical some of the stories we're already talking about, kidnapping, labor moving force, forced labor in some cases. All things fair and love and war. I mean, I don't know about love, but war seems that there are no limits. You're exactly right.
No, and in the case of those kidnappings, it's even worse because the U.S. authorities took away all of the documentation from the people that they put on these ships and brought to the States so that the people, when they arrived, could be called illegal aliens and therefore be put in these camps. It's very, very Machiavellian. And therefore, when the war was ended, these people had nowhere to go. Some of them had to stay in these camps for 2 years after the war. And on top of everything, Peru would not take back its Japanese. Peru was just as had just as much racism in that country as we had in ours at the time. So the effects go on and on and on.
And that's a tactic, as we know, that's used by traffickers everywhere now. As you know, you always read in terms of sex trafficking and other kinds of problems that the first thing they do is take away the passport, and you know, these women are stuck. But it looks like we were out there helping invent that tactic too. We're talking to Mary Jo Conahy, who's written a fascinating book called The Tango War, which, as you can already tell, opens up a lot of windows and doors that a lot of us would prefer not to have ever believed could be open. But there's some terrible things happening in the world. On the Becerra program, people were supposed to be short-term, though, correct? They were in for a specific period of time?
The program itself was meant to be a stopgap. But it was so convenient, and so many people who had been working in the fields didn't want to go back to the fields. And so we really needed these workers from Mexico. Just as today, you hear many farmers and ranchers saying, we absolutely need a workforce such as people who have come up from Mexico and other places and are willing to do this really tough work out there in the fields.
And certainly that's true in the service industry as well. I mean, you still hear, you know, New York and other cities, restaurants and hospitality folks, you know, crying about the need for immigrant labor, sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes for the wrong reasons. But there's no question there's a lot of that. You pull these threads back together in looking at how this influenced not only World War II, but the Cold War and contemporary events. How do you see those threads being woven?
Well, again, this idea that war doesn't end once you've started is very palpable when you look at Latin America in the 1980s. You know, the United States won the war. It really took hegemony over Latin America in many ways, and it was the Cold War. So we supported dictators who were not fascist in philosophy, but anti-communist in philosophy, and nevertheless were responsible for mass murders, probably some 400,000 people, mostly civilians, almost all civilians, died during that period at the hands of these autocratic dictators and militarized societies. And in some cases, the torturers were fascist, or would scrawl, for instance, in Chile or in Argentina, would scrawl the swastikas on the walls of the torture chambers. And the fascism and the anti-communism seemed to kind of mix, you might say. And the climate of fear carried over. In fact, it was installed during the Cold War in a way it hadn't been during World War II among ordinary people in many places.
And some of these same tactics that had been allowed to be legitimized, including by the U.S., like kidnapping and disappearing people, if you will, mm-hmm. became also common in places like Argentina.
Argentina, Guatemala.
Exactly.
El Salvador.
And
it became the custom of the day.
I think it was only a month or so or two ago, one of the mothers who used to demonstrate in the plaza in Buenos Aires finally passed away, who used to, you know, represent the disappeared ones. We
yes,
worked there for a long time.
Yes, but they still walk around the plaza.
Absolutely.
On Thursdays, I think it is, just because one goes, the struggle to find these young people who are now in their 30s or 40s, who were taken away from their mothers when they were born, and then the mothers were killed. These family members, they just don't stop when they keep on looking for their family members.
And certainly, as we can imagine, we do the same. Now, how has this influenced the people's memories are not long, and history is too often shrouded in the shadows, as you argue in your book. But how do people? How does this affect it, how people see the United States and Latin America? Do you have a thought on that or a speculation? I mean, you
right,
and I can't be experts,
bit,
and it's
it
not really in your book. But
it is speculative, but there is some impressionistic things. I remember when Obama was first elected, there was a great deal of celebration throughout Latin America. And I'm talking about just ordinary folks,
absolutely,
not necessarily in the state houses. And when Trump was elected, they were making piñatas of Trump. Piñatas are these things, these paper mache images that you strike, and a lot of candy comes out during the birthdays. And they were at first being very, how would you say it, dismissive of Trump. But now, with the way that the United States is in many ways ignoring Latin America and has no foreign policy really in Latin America, and has tariffs on some of its best commercial friends in Latin America, there's a great deal of, shall we say, concern about the relationships.
I think people don't realize, certainly you do from having covered Latin America so long, but people in Latin America follow politics in the U.S. I mean, I still remember going to our offices down there and people asking about Bush, I mean, or now about Obama, and then currently, obviously, about Trump. I mean, they're always trying to place you on the political spectrum based on what they're understanding down there. We were talking about some of the fascist relocation in Latin America, but there's another story on the Jewish side too, isn't there?
Yes. Well, you know, Jews lived in Latin America from earliest days. It's something that's very little appreciated. There were two Jews in the crew of Columbus when he landed. In fact, it was a Jew who first sighted land and another who first set foot on land from Columbus's crew. And of course, the Inquisition, being a Spanish and Portuguese institution, was present and did target Jews. But there wasn't the depth and the cruelty in Latin America that there was still in Europe. And eventually, toward the end of the 19th century, the countries were inviting Jews. Of course, the cruelty is long gone of the Inquisition, and they're inviting them to be settlers. And there are important Jewish communities in many countries. Argentina has the largest in Latin America. There's an important Jewish community in Mexico, in Brazil, and they, nevertheless, during the war, had the doors shut on them.
Which is,
why?
Yeah.
Because, first of all, the anti-Semitism just seemed to rise to the surface when it had the chance, but also because the Latin American countries followed the lead of the United States, which had very restrictive policies toward the immigration of Jews. In fact, restrictive policies for Italians and Chinese at the time. Until 1964, these kind of restrictions were on the books, and there was very little space made for Jews in the United States during the war, and equally so in Latin America, to the point that there are some rather tragic stories.
Yes, and we could spend a lot of time on that. This has been Mary Jo McConaughey talking about her book, The Tango Wars, The Struggles for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. You can get it certainly in Amazon, your local bookseller, and anywhere else. Mary Jo, thank you so much for being with us. As people can tell, there's a lot in this book that you don't want to know, but you need to know. And I hope you'll get a hold of Mary Jo's book. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wage World.